I'm Matt Brailsford.
I'm Kevin Jump.
I'm Lee Kelleher.
And you're listening to Package Manifest,
a podcast all about Umbraco packages.
We're back, baby.
Yay.
Woo! My God, it's been a whole year since we recorded it last. A year and a half.
Yeah.
Wow. So we've got another host this season.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh.
Hello.
Hello. It's Mr. Lee Keller. How many time MVP?
We don't talk. I don't talk about this in front of you, Matt.
I know.
12.
Yeah.
It's okay. We're still both beating Kevin. That's fine.
Yes.
Cool. So how are we all doing? Are we glad to be back?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yes, very excited to be part of this now.
Ready for a new season?
Well, we have a list of things we're going to say, so yes, I think we are.
I mean, I don't think we were technically ready for the first season, but, you know, we'll carry on with the same process. So, shall we do similar to last year and start with some successes?
Yeah, why not?
I mean, I might go first because I think mine's probably quite an obvious one. If you don't know, my company was acquired by Umbraco. So I'm now on the other side.
Ooh.
I'm a sellout. Okay. I know you want to say that.
It's a great success.
Yes.
Yeah, very much so for us. I won't go too much into it because I think we might do an actual episode on it. But needless to say, something we're really pleased about. And marks a really good success for Vendor as a product. So I'm really pleased about that. Kevin, anything you're proud about over the last 12 months?
12 months. I see it. Keeping it topical and to beat Lee, you sinks in the Umbraco Package Hall of Fame. That's always contentment. But yes. No, loads of stuff. Last 12 months have been quite busy, really. I was looking back and there's a lot. We actually, the last podcast, I don't think Umbraco 9 was even out when we stopped.
Wow.
And now we're at Release Canada for 12. So lots of running over the last 12 months. Lots and lots, lots of package releases. But yeah, doing really well. Quite pleased. Ooh. Yeah.
Lee?
Oh, a lot's changed with me. I've left my agency umbrella and been doing a bit of freelancing, but, you know, not too heavy. Ticking over, I guess. Focusing on lots of music stuff. So yeah, kind of focusing on band stuff. But yeah, contentment is, as Kevin said, in the Hall of Fame. So it's quite cool.
Nice.
I also, non-Umbraco related, the proudest thing of the year, I've made a thing to keep me butter warm.
Explain.
So, yeah, so really complicated, but using the heat pad you get for, apparently, like if you've got a lizard, I haven't got a lizard, and you can put the heat pad and a temperature sensor to keep me butter at 19.5 degrees. So in the winter, I've got spreadable butter.
Wow.
Turns out you can buy something, but actually you can't. It's really hard to acquire. So
Spreadable butter.
Yeah. No, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it cost of living. Spreadable butter is very expensive. So
how the other half live?
Hi, yeah, now. It's all that you sink money. It's a heated butter dish.
Okay, so let's begin. Try and remember how we do this stuff.
Do you do power poses? You know that
it doesn't work that well on a podcast, but we can.
Apparently, it doesn't work.
Do you do them that way? On the hips.
Yeah,
fists on the hips. I was just showing you what I was doing.
Okay.
There we go.
Oh, yeah.
So, if you haven't guessed, that means we've got a guest with us today, and that guest would be Lottie. So, hi, Lottie.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me along to the first episode of the new series.
I know. It's been a while. It's been a whole year since season one.
You do know you were on the last episode of the last series as well.
Mm.
So
what's it called? Continuity?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I'll be a guest host for the whole of series three. Is that how it works?
I think
so. Sure.
Yeah, sure.
You're contractually obliged now. but we've got you on today, Lottie, because our topic for this episode is opinionated, and you recently released a opinionated package starter kit.
Yes, I did. It was. Is it true to say it's unlike me to have opinions? I'm not sure. But it turns out that having been package developing for a while, with a lot of help actually from the three people I'm looking at now, I realised that I learned a lot of things. I made some decisions. Lee especially talked me through lots of options that there were. And when I thought about if I wanted to build another package, I just want to do it the same way again. And GitHub Actions works, for example, with tagging. Why not just do it that way again? And then I remembered these things called .NET new templates that Kevin and I on the package team have done a fair bit with. And so I thought I'd turn what I built as a result with Lee's help as a .NET new template. And yes, I made lots of decisions for people and thus called it the opinionated package starter template, because it decides things like your namespace and what you should be putting in a .github folder, so that when you release it and push it to GitHub, you actually have some nice issue templates already there and readmes in the right places and a different readme for NuGet and all that sort of thing. So yes, it makes lots. You could call it a sort of decision starter template. It's made lots of decisions for you, but opinionated just sounded more fun.
I wanted to call it Lottie's sensible package starter kit, but yeah.
Okay. Hopefully sensible. Can I take this opportunity to apologise to Kevin, actually? Ooh. Because after I released it, which I did in the early hours of Spark, on the train back to London, I enjoyed reading lots of discussions between yourself, Kevin, and Anders.
Yeah.
In Denmark, and you did a pull request so that one of the opinions which was made, which was to use the app plugins folder instead of a Razor class library, you did a pull request so that it would support Razor class libraries in Braco version 10. And I realized I still actually haven't merged that, for which I can only apologize and promise that it is on my to-do list.
That's okay. I think that's part of the opinionated. You get to choose.
But I do know, because some few people have let me know that they've been using it. And so I've been saying, oh, and make sure you have a look at the pull request from Kevin, because you should be using, I do believe you should be using Razor class libraries now. So my opinion has been changed by the fact that you very kindly explained all about them. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. That's one of the things I've... Razor class libraries is probably why it needs to be opinionated, because that's we working on the package team before I abandoned it. Actually getting things like that into core libraries is really hard, because obviously there's so many ways of doing even the Razor class library, and that PR has got like three or four different ways of just where the folders live. So at some point you do need to have that opinionated bit where you can just say, no, this is the way I want to do it.
So. Well, I like having a C# package manifest.
Yeah,
implementation. But I can appreciate that not everyone does. So yeah, this is fun, because it's my opinion goes, right?
Yes.
Mainly Lee's opinions, but I agree with them.
Yeah, it's funny looking through the repo and subsequent packages that I've now seen, because I know Paul Seals released the Quick Blocks package, which is based on your opinionated starter kit. I keep saying starter kit, starter template. I had a look through his code and I was like, hey, these are similar to mine. I've seen this before. So yeah, it's quite interesting seeing how that kind of propagates.
Yeah, well, I did joke, I think, at Spark, I've just turned you, Lee, into a .NET new template. So
become a commodity.
Easy. Yeah, it's really easy to clone. We need to just work out how to do that with Callum and then we'll be fine. I would say it's mainly Lee with a sprinkling of Matt and Kevin.
My opinions came from a lot of the things that that Matt and I did, you know, for the other packages back in the day. So yeah, just all, well, as we always say, standing on the shoulders of giants, right?
Yeah, I do need to do pull requests on the three people that I know who've used them, because I forgot there's a GUID in the app settings of the test site that wasn't in the list of GUIDs that the template should change. I don't think it matters. I think it's just some Bracco's telemetry that might get a little confused. But I will do that and fix that. It's quite fun releasing a tool, though, that people use to get started and then they take it in their own direction, because after they've used it, there's no callback to me. Unlike you people who release packages that have to keep working, this is a kind of a one-off use thing. So it's kind of quite fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I do wonder, if you made updates, then will they get those updates? I can't figure out how that part works.
I would never expect anyone to.
No, you've taken update. That at that point, then you've moved on, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I think updates to templates. Update the template, but only the next time you create something with it. So if you do a .NET new it, that's it set in time. If you update in between and do a .NET new it again, you get a new one. But you can't update, like, patch updates into it, I think.
I do need to set up a... I realise I haven't got a GitHub action set up to release the template. Oh. It all gets a bit meta because you're... updating a source of a template in a folder, which is then inside another, which you're then releasing to NuGet. And part of what you're releasing is the ability to release it. It gets quite confusing. I think that's why I took some time off. And then I got back, I was looking at it again this morning, because obviously I knew I was coming on this and thinking, oh, I'll just have a look at this. And I went, oh, I remember that. It's quite complicated, isn't it? You have to make sure you've got a clear head when you're working on these things. I'll get there.
Yeah, one of GitHub Actions is where my opinionated starts, because I can never get them working enough. I can get it to build, but I never really trust them to actually, even though in theory they're the thing that you should trust, I don't actually build and deploy packages with the GitHub Actions. I do it with PowerShell scripts.
I've not used GitHub Actions, but we use DevOps quite a lot, so we always have done, even with vendor and construct and those things. And for us, it was always made things a lot easier in terms of being able to release stuff quickly. So we had it all automated that we could just commit a change to the repo and it would go through Azure DevOps, get built, get pushed to an unstable feed, and we could get instant feedback. So we've done that on all our projects. It has kind of changed. So on vendor and construct, I used to use something called Nuke Build, which is a C# build library, because I had the opinion for a while, and it is a good, useful opinion, but that build script is all written in C#, so it gives you a lot of power in terms of being able to reuse packages from NuGet, like within your build process. If you need to modify JSON, you can just use Nutansoft. And another good thing with that is you could run that build process locally. So a lot of issues I find with DevOps is you can only run them in the actual environment that they're intended to run in, which is on that platform. So you can't, if you need to run your build scripts locally, generate some local package files, if you're putting that responsibility in GitHub Actions, then you're not going to be able to actually make those locally. So Nuke Build allowed us to put it all in C# and we could run them locally. But having moved to HQ, I'm now in the YAML world.
I think there is something that lets you run GitHub Actions locally in Visual Studio Code, but probably an awful lot of things takes 14 days of NPM installing to actually get to the point where you can use it.
To be fair, I think a lot of what I was doing was, I don't know if I didn't really know like SDK projects properly. So I found a lot of my scripts that I had in C# were doing things that could have been done just in standard SDK projects. So things like we had a vendor NuGet package, which was really just an entry point, didn't have any code in it. It just had a reference to like the UI files and then the like backend logic or core DLLs. So its only responsibility was to pull both of them in at the same time so that if you install it on your actual web project, it would install the UI files. But if you're installing on like your class libraries where you usually put all your business logic, then you wouldn't install that. You'd install one of the like core DLL NuGet packages. But the way I was doing that was I had a new spec file that I manually, within our build script, like created a NuGet package with that, rather than what we're doing now is I just have an empty project, yeah. And I didn't know you could have a setting in your proj file that said don't include any build outputs. So really, I don't think I understood the SDK projects properly. And so now the current setup that I'm using, it's all in the project files and there's no need. Like, I basically went through the C# build script and kept removing bits, and I was effectively at a point where it was just .NET pack. So it's like, well, what's the point of this C# build script when all I'm really doing is wrapping .NET pack? So in the end, it didn't seem worth it.
Yeah. I think ours are back to .NET pack, but we do minify stuff, but I actually think we do that in a task in the Visual Studio, so it's still a .NET pack, but it runs minify stuff, because we minify the JavaScript before you sync. We don't do it for anything else, because other people's packages break things, and then everyone blames uSync because it's the one everyone's got installed. I've got uSync installed, and it's nothing. It's the way it minifies them together, and so we minify uSync itself, so it's sort of self-contained and can't necessarily be the single point of failure that sometimes, you know, when Umbraco combines it all itself in the package, it does its own munging.
Yeah.
We chose not to do that, take it out of that and do our independent bundling of that package, which is a pain because it breaks some of the RCL stuff. But
well, we've got that in Fender, the Umbraco flavored version, which I can't tell you the name yet, but the Umbraco flavored version of Fender is that uses Razor class libraries for all its static assets as well. But that's got similar gulp build scripts that will minify or at least combine all of the JavaScript files into one, and also replace any Angular directive inline template, referenced templates on disk, and convert them into inline templates. So there is a gulp build script, but that again is triggered now by the normal .NET or the usual .NET build environment. So when it's compiling the actual Razor class library, it will trigger as part of that build the gulp build as well.
But it's all over the top, right? We don't need to do gulp build scripts.
You see, just listening to you lot now, sorry to interrupt, but it just reminds me of just how complicated this feels to the outside world. Yeah. And it doesn't, I mean, I know for the big packages, you need to do more complicated things, but this is part of the reason why building this appealed to me, was because if you just want to release a package that's adding some functionality to the Umbraco back office, you don't have to understand everything that you've just been talking about. And chances are you've been working in an agency where someone else has set up the DevOps process and you just know how to commit or tag or whatever it is that works in your company in order to get things released. And then suddenly you're coming to doing your own releases to NuGet. And if you've never released a package to NuGet before, then taking an easy option is a good way to get started, which we can now. I appreciate that when the three of you back in the day started with your package development, there was no easy option. And you did have to write all these custom build scripts and you did have to jump through all the hoops. And I remember when I joined the package team and realized quite what was involved back then, I was just impressed that anyone managed to release a package, to be honest. but now I think with the tooling in Visual Studio, with the functionality of GitHub, it is so much easier. And of course, you're welcome to build all your scripts. And I just avoid the word gulp if I can, and all the other
things. I don't think it's that those things were necessary. I think it's when you get to a point where either you've got a number of packages that you're constantly doing the same things again and again, or you're building something relatively big and you find you've got a lot of scripts that you're pulling in or loading in. You just eventually get to a point where you're going to need to try and optimize that a little bit more. So whether that's minifying it, whether that's just combining them into one file, because it's easy to have them as individual files because it makes it easy for debugging whilst you're doing development, but it would be more performant to then have them as one file when you actually distribute them. So it's a case of, do you have those files and manually do that every time you prepare a release, which is a little bit unrealistic to kind of put that on yourself to remember every time to do that, or you go down the route of a build script to take that pressure away and just make it an automatic thing. So I think that's, yes, it's another tool in the tool chain, but I think once you get to a certain level or once you're doing it multiple times, that it becomes worth the effort to invest in learning not everything, but just enough. Like, I hate Gulp. Like, I don't know about Gulp. Like, when I'm writing my Gulp script, I'm spending all my time on Google just trying to find examples of how you do it. So I don't know how to use it, but it's another one of those things that once it's in place and it works, you generally don't have to touch it. So it's spending a bit of time to research and make it work, but once that's in place, then you don't need to potentially touch it again.
I came at the bundling and minification for Contentment and some other packages as well, from a different angle. So my kind of like fear was that when I started making, like, say, Contentment, there was lots of property editors, and I wanted to separate all these into their own kind of like feature folders, but they all had their own JavaScript files. And then the initial build that I did was, I don't know, there must have been about like 40 JavaScript files. And then I was thinking, I don't want 40 HTTP requests, you know, for anyone who's installed in this. I want, you know, just to kind of, you know, to minimize the number of kind of chatter between the client and the server. I just want it to be in one JavaScript file rather than, you know, many, many requests happening. I know with like HTTP2, it's meant to be less of an issue, but if I was thinking the less files I have, you know, kind of the more environmentally friendly, I guess it would be. So that was the kind of the reason to kind of, you know, bundle and minify things. From my perspective, I get, you know, that's the same for most of us as well, but not just for, you know, ease of delivery, but also the day-to-day usage of these packages.
And where does your minification happen, Lee?
Well, I don't use Gulp. I've been very, very old school. So I've used something called the Microsoft Ajax tool. No, it's not Ajax toolkit. Microsoft Ajax minification executable file. It's like a 5 meg file that will minify CSS and JavaScript. So I've added that to my build process, but it's opinionated because it's not using npm, you know, modules or anything. So I've had some people in the past ask me, you know, I can't build Contentment because I can't find this certain file, and there's something in the build script that says, oh, you can download it from here, but it's not an automated thing. So but, you know, Wasp Contentment's been going for 4 years, and I've only had two people ask me about it. So, yeah, I don't think everyone's building it from source. Yeah.
You see, I came over from a different angle, the third way. I did it because I only really do this stuff on Usync, to be perfectly honest, on Translation Manager. I don't do it on any of the other ones because I do think it's a bit of a faff. It's easier to debug them. But I think I'm going to say in Breco 9 point something, there was some form of bug in the tool chain that actually minifies an Breco that made it slow. And so when you threw Usync at it unminified, it could take like a couple of seconds to minify the scripts. And that was an N+1 problem. So the more packages you installed, the longer that builds process got. And so I was responding to support or potential support because I could see the problem of minify before someone complains. And that's most of what my opinionated stuff in the packages is do this before I've noticed something, I'm going to do it before someone else complains about it. Because I think I only really put these things in to make support easier, if I'm honest. I prefer, and a couple of the smaller packages are done, the nice, clean, you just put the files in, Razor does its thing, you don't dirty up the build process, it is nice and clean. But when it comes to things like Usync, everyone's got it, and it's got loads of files. I bungle them all together again to try and reduce the potential pain points. Because one of the things you get with Razor class libraries is just people saying, I can't see the files, or I used to do this and I don't do this anymore.
It does feel a bit weird, Dan.
It is a bit odd. It is odd for me. And I get I had one last week where people, it was a translation manager one and it wasn't working. And they hadn't cleaned up, even though the build script does clean up the old version 9 was not Razor and version 10 is. So the build will clean the Translation Manager app plugins folder because it should no longer be there. But when you then deploy, a lot of default deployment is not to delete files that are already on the environment. So if you do it with Azure, it just adds the new files. And I think they add the old package still there. And then they're getting confused because where are these files coming from? Or why is it not working? I've got this version installed. That's a transition problem. I think it goes away, but people don't necessarily grasp it. It's weird when you, if you're not working with it all the time, that your website isn't even coming from that folder. And people put it on IIS and it doesn't work, and that's because the file permissions are wrong. And so I don't know. I think it, once you've got your head around it, I think it's a much better way of working. But I would say that from my viewpoint at this side of it.
Well, I think that's the thing. Like, I've always been a bit mixed on Razor Class libraries because I guess coming from the angle that learning a lot from other people's code, essentially. So the old days of being able to view source on a website and actually see how it was built, that's how I learned a lot of building websites. And similarly, in packages, you might look at what they're doing in the JavaScript and see where it's what it's doing, how it's working. And Razor Class libraries just seem to take all of that away. Now, I will say I've embraced them quite heavily in terms of what we're doing now. So the new vendor does make use of it. So again, it's not going to have any static assets on disk. And even to the extent that now all the default templates, so even the Razor templates for like emails and things, they're all fed from an RCL. So they're not actually on disk initially. So it is going to be interesting to see how that goes, both from a, I don't know how many people actually poked around the JavaScript or debugged the JavaScript if they found an issue, or has anybody overwritten any JavaScript files if they found something and found a way to fix it without necessarily reporting it.
But you don't want those people. The people who change your code, you don't want those people.
It also, but then you're in a position where they had the ability to fix a problem, yeah. Whereas now they don't, and it's
yeah. I think they technically do, but there is possible.
They can only to an extent.
It's in an order. I wouldn't personally recommend it at all, but you can do it. You can overwrite them if you put the files they should be.
No, you can only override Razor files.
You can't override the static ones. I think there is another way to do it, but it's not worth going into. but equally, I would argue from a package point of view, it is better that people are not changing the package files that are there, because the support nightmare of someone changing a JavaScript file is huge.
But there's no doubt that a whole wealth of Umbraco developers learn how to customize the back office by looking in the models builder app plugins folder and the usync one.
The usync one is still there. If it's on your disk still, because they're not embedded in the DLL, they're in the package and they're copied across by Razor. So they're in the NuGet packages cache, which is in your user profile .nuget/packages/the name of the package. And you can actually see all the files there, because what Razor actually does with static assets is not a million miles away to what was the way it was when Umbraco 9 came out with the Umbraco way, where it was copying files on build. It's doing a similar thing when you publish. It's essentially copying the files from the cache. But when you're running locally, what it's doing is pretending the cache is in your website. So the files for usync anyway are all in the NuGet cache. You can go and steal them, but equally you can right click in Chrome and it looks like they're all on your site.
Is there any reason, if you have a package that is using app plugins now and you've finally got your targets file right, so they get copied over correctly, is that going to stop working? App plugins going to stop being supported at any point in the near future? Are people going to have to move to Razor?
I think if we ignore version 14 and UUUUI, the app plugins will just work, because it's just a convention inside Umbraco that these things live in a folder called app plugins. And all that's changed in Umbraco, obviously it's more than just simple, is it uses a virtual file system as opposed to the physical disk, and it looks for /app plugins. And so that can be physically in the site still, or virtually from a Razer class folder. And yeah, that'll work unless someone takes out that logic that it lives in our plugins.
Another side to that is potentially with the new web components as well. How I said I learned a lot with right-click view source. So web components, the shadow DOM will essentially hide a lot of your markup. So it means you won't see the actual markup that makes up different components. Your component will just appear as your component tag in the source of the browser. So people, again, won't be able to see what actually fundamentally makes up your components underneath. So it's just interesting, and I think it's just a new way that people are going to be working with packages and products and things, but it's just quite closed off compared to how at least I've grown up in this kind of world.
Yeah, there does seem to be that fundamental shift, and I can't remember exactly when it happened. Where the likes of us were, we were learning how to do HTML, CSS, and JavaScript by looking at other websites. You were view source everything compared to compiled, websites now, which the effectively are. How do you reverse engineer, a React website? Who knows? There may be ways of doing it, but I don't know. So this may be the same with the Embraco back office. It's now become just a compiled web, or it will become just a compiled web app. Why would anyone want to view source? But in that, as Lottie was saying earlier, you lose that the next generation of potential package developers who can try to figure out how things were built together. You need to now have the knowledge of, this is how it works once it's compiled. Where's the source? I need to go back and kind of, figure out the logic of how that was all put together.
I do think there's probably tooling, and I think maybe I'm stuck in like old ways of debugging and whatnot. But I know for sure in things like React and Vue, there are definitely tools that can be added to, like dev tools, to give you a lot more insight into what's actually going on in the application. So I don't know, but I would assume there's similar tools as well, potentially for web components, to be able to actually debug into components themselves. So I don't think it's all gone and you don't have that ability. Maybe it's just the tooling hasn't caught up, or I haven't caught up with the tooling. Which is probably more the latter than the former, but
yeah, I'm wondering if there are some sort of some front end developers listening to this going, you just don't know what you're talking about.
Probably,
but that's it. Like, because of all the back office customization, so much of it is front end work, and as far as I know, a lot of it's been done by back end developers. We've been able to achieve it by pattern matching of what other people have done, and if I may quote you, Lee, I think I remember you saying that you would never count yourself as an AngularJS developer despite what you've managed to achieve in Embraco back offices, but because you could never start a new application, you'd never start a new AngularJS application. And we've been able to get a long way without needing to become a full stack developer and become an expert in the front end. And that's what the future is. It's slightly daunting for those of us who are getting quite tired of all the new things we have to learn. And here's a question: can I retire, or is it too early?
I've been having the same thought.
It's
not about you, but about
thanks.
So coming back to the word opinionated in your package template, Lottie, were there any kind of opinions that you weren't completely sold on, but you went with because you thought, oh, it's the done thing, like either myself or Matt or Kevin do these kind of things. Yeah, you didn't want to upset me, but you kind of thought like, did you make any compromises?
Not that I remember, although actually in this discussion now, I'm just, am I rethinking app plugins versus RCLs? No, I don't think I am. I think I will change it. No, because actually what I've enjoyed is understanding the different ways and and realizing that the ways that have been taken do make sense. An example, there's an issue from Anders pointing out how I can change it so that its dependency is on 10.00 rather than 10.4, which was the version of Umbraco that was out when I first started it. And he's taken the time to not just show me how to do it, but explain why and all of this. And it's like, ah, that makes sense. Brilliant. Yes, I will change that then. And I think because the help I've had from other people in taking the time to explain the different ways, I actually don't think there isn't anything that I think is a big controversial thing here. I mean, using the umbraco.community NuGet prefix, that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, if you've got a company name, then you could do that. But that already took out some thoughts. I mean, let's face it, the biggest challenge with a package is what's the name? What are you going to call it? And that is something that you have to put in the template. I haven't got, an AI implementation to generate a name for you, maybe. But anyway, you had to say AI at some point, didn't you? So it doesn't give you any opinions on what the name should be. But no, I think otherwise, off the top of my head, Lee, there isn't anything that I disagree with.
I recall we were having conversations about SEMVER, semantic versioning, if anyone's not with the lingo, on what your initial like version number should be. Because there's I think in SEMVER, it's like you're on version zero and your first release is like, 0.10. But I can't remember if you opted to, what did you decide on in the end? Did you decide on V1 or was it V0 for like
this? It's 0.1.0.
Okay. So you went with my opinion.
I mean, I don't want to give you a big head, Lee, but generally I agree with you. Contextualized to Umbraco packages. Let's not say to the wider world. But considering how long you've been doing this, it probably makes sense that I should agree with you. I really wish there was one thing that we did disagree on and that I went in a different version, but
you picked a different license.
I did pick a different license, but I went with the one that Umbraco uses, so it's hardly a controversial opinion to use an MIT license.
You certainly shouldn't talk to me about versioning because I don't agree with myself. So I've no idea. I've got things of version 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 4. They're just all over the place.
I have slipped in new, if I was sticking to strict SEMVER, little features in contentment have been put out in a patch release, which I shouldn't be doing.
But I, a while, and I don't know if we talked about this last time, but it's so long ago, as it was not SEMVER, some form of Umbraco version thing in my head. Because if you bring out something that's fairly big, but you're supporting version 10, and you've decided to call it version 10, I can't bring out version 11 that's on version 10 now, can I? Because that becomes really complicated. So, like a pat point release can have big things in it. Try not to be breaking. But yeah, that's the thing I've sort of trapped myself in. By having version 10 and 11 of Usync supporting 10 and 11 is I can't necessarily drop a major feature and say now it's called version 11. And it's just horrible. I don't know what I did.
There might be something actually that's just occurred to me. How do you feel about having a test site committed in the repo, Lee? Oh, shaking your head.
I was against it for a while, but I've come around to it, and now Contentment has several test sites in there. So yes, I've come around to it.
If you use Usync, you can do it quite. I do it with Usync. I think I might not do it with Usync itself, but I do it with other things because you can with 10 now, and it's not necessarily a Usync thing. You can set up the auto build, auto stuff, so that if someone does check out your repo, it sort of just becomes a test repo. So I do use Usync for that a bit. So you install the package and the test repo has Usync on it so that when you then install it the first time you kick it on, it will build the site. And that's what the first boot stuff in Usync was written for, really, so that you could put a test site somewhere and then when you span it up, it also fills in everything.
I've just remembered why I'm okay with having test sites now in the repo, because previously, like in, going back to like the V4 days or even earlier, is that you would have to commit a lot of Umbraco files in there. Mm. So all this stuff we're talking about now with, like, you know, the Rails class libraries and NuGet in general, I can just reference the NuGet packages. I'm not having to commit all of the Umbraco files into the repository, which was one of my major bugbears with doing that. So you kind of you form these opinions, right? Which is, no, don't put the Umbraco test site in there because you're just bloating things.
Yeah, and opinions that yeah. made sense at the time, and actually revisiting it now is that, because I've committed the SQL database as well, just because that was the easiest way to do it. But I think, Kevin, what you're saying is actually I should remove the database and use Usync to.
Yeah, or just remove the database and have, if you've got like the starter kit installed, just have the auto stuff. So when they build the site the first time, they just get the site with a starter kit and it's a blank site for them. And then at least it's there. I do it because I think it makes it easier for other people to pick up the repo of the sites in there and work out what's going on.
Because I think for just ease of testing for my package, there's three doc types set up with the different mm-hmm. permutations that you can have. And, you know, it's just quite nice that then when someone says this doesn't work, I spin it up and I go, yes, it does. But yeah. I obviously put a longer sentence on the issue than that. But because it's funny, because it's now, having looked at the people who've created packages using the template, I'm like, oh, this, as you say, Lee, oh, this looks familiar. And then, oh, yes, they've still got a test site. Oh, yes, they've still got that GUID that I need to change for them. And they've committed the databases as well, I think, as well. So, but I mean, it works, and they're not big. And who cares about disk space? And who cares? No one's paying for GitHub space, are they? So, oh, sorry.
We all are.
Are we?
Environmentally, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to get.
I was thinking more where you all are, because the ChatGPT is going to read your code and take your job, but that's okay.
That's a very good point. So if I remove the database from the repo and use Usync to create things on startup, I'm doing my bit for the environment?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Maybe not in processing power. I don't know. It's a difficult one.
Well, it's in the issues list anyway to consider doing that. So, because I do know that that's one that people, I'm not saying it's a hill they're going to die on as to whether to have a test site and or a database, but yeah
with the database thing, or I think with contentment, I just went with Usync to try to, you know, to get the website started up. And I don't know if it is first boot or you have to I think it is first boot, Kevin, where it just just restores the Umbraco site when you first run it. So That's the approach I took, as opposed to committing the like the SQLite database or SQL CE, what it was for V8.
On the issue I've created on my repo, I've actually put a link to contentment as a reminder that you do it this way. And in this unique situation, I agree with you, Lee.
One example that I can remember of us being quite opinionated, Lee, Togglegate.
Yes.
So for anybody that doesn't know, me and Lee were behind nested content. And I guess for a little bit of background on nested content, prior to nested content being released, there was another one, archetype, which was pretty much on everybody's install around that time. It allowed you to do repeated content items. But it was very powerful, had quite a lot of features, and was basically not accepting everybody's request, but basically anybody with a good reason for wanting another feature, it kind of seemed to just spiral and get more and more features, which, great, it made it more useful for more people. But I think in our mind at the time, we were, could this be simplified? Could it be boiled down to, like, what is the core goal of what this is doing? So we came up with nested content, released that, and one of the key things that people missed from Archetype was an ability to essentially disable an item. So not fully delete it, but just disable it and not have it shown on the front end. So we took the stance that putting a toggle on there to allow that wasn't necessary. And that got interesting.
Yeah, we had very, very long debates on whether that feature should go in. I mean, yeah, so we had to deal with that like controversy in the package, but then it escalated a lot bigger once nested content got into the core of Umbraco. But yeah, I remember the reasons at the time. We were kind of thinking that, you know, logistics of like how do you show this in the back office, you know, for something that's disabled, you need a kind of different state, and the things were just starting to get not too complicated. It could be solved, but we wanted to keep nested content simple, really, you know, not add too many features, not, you know, these things. We didn't really see these things as nodes, you know, because that's the way they start to get treated. So like in Archetype, you know, you had this visibility state, you know, whether, you know, it was shown or hidden. They also had their own publication date on there as well. So you can, and unpublication date. So you can say, oh, I want this block to show at a certain date and then disappear on a certain date. It felt like they were just reproducing what the functionality of a node was in Umbraco. Whereas I think once we'd had discussions around whether, you know, that functionality was in nested content, it was just more, well, Umbraco should really be able to do subnodes or what later became element types. So, you know, they should do element types more natively, and then we can handle that rather than we try to build all this functionality into basically JavaScript blobs. Yeah, so we made the decision to kind of, you know, to not do that feature.
I think it's really interesting because, I mean, did you get a lot of the people who were pushing it back to you, were they actually coming to you? Were you getting accosted in conferences about this? Was it that bad?
There was a couple of times where somebody said, like, I really need this feature for our client. You know, they absolutely have to have this feature. And, you know, and I'm there at a conference, well, as it was at a Code Garden, and it's like, well, I don't know what to tell you, you know, like, you know, it's we've made a decision at that point in time. And then they just kind of just got upset with me. And that, I don't really know how that goes from there.
Definitely when nested content got merged into core, I think it was around the time of like people questioning what is open source and what is Umbraco's responsibility. Are they product owners and product like leaders? Are they, their responsibilities that delivery, like having a mission and a focus and building what they believe the product was to be? Or is it meant to be true democracy that anybody can have any feature if enough people wanted it? And I think that's definitely what was happening around that time, is trying to find those boundaries and maybe defining them. So I don't know whether people were really that emotive over that feature, but I don't know whether it was chosen as kind of a point to be made of, like, enough people are asking for this, so just do it. And it wasn't, yeah, I think they were trying to see what is the community's role in this. Are we like, why can we not influence this how we think it should be influenced? And I think it's interesting from a package developer perspective as well, because I guess we take that viewpoint sometimes as well, which is you want to get feedback, you want people to have influence and tell you what they need. But I know from vendor's perspective, I would listen to what people said they wanted, and I would distill it and do it in my way, but not even necessarily do it. You would implement something which allowed it. So like I was always more about the extension point. So if somebody needed something, I might be thinking more about, well, if I do this, then they could make that. They could build an integration that allowed that to happen. But I'm not necessarily just going to go and do it. But you see what I mean? I guess there's a difference between.
Well, there's an you have to have ownership, don't you? And an open source project can't quite descend into free for all because it becomes a bit anarchy, and also will bloat and will just become unmaintainable. So there always needs to be some form of gatekeeping. And that's where that is, I suppose, is hard to do. Because I get similar with using stuff. People want extra features. And as you say, extensibility sort of is a nice get out. Because you can say to people, well, you can hook in here. But that doesn't stop people saying this would be a really good feature or this would be really good. And you do have to, a project has to have an owner that makes those decisions. Otherwise, it'd be insanely complicated. Much more complicated than the stuff I write now, which is stupidly complicated for people to understand. So I think I've got to the point, it's really hard because how many people asking for something is a flag. I sort of go, if someone asks me now for a feature, and I'll look at it. It does depend on how complicated the thing they're asking for is, but it'll be, no one else has asked for this. So is it a thing? And it's how do you know that? It's really hard to gauge. Now, obviously, with the tab thing, people were asking about how many people. It's still really hard to say there's enough of a groundswell here to make a change or to change your mind. And ultimately, you have the right not to because it's your product. They can always fork it and do whatever they want, but no one ever does that, so.
If I'm allowed to plug another podcast on this podcast, on Candid Contributions, great podcast, by the way, we had Per Plug, ex Embraco HQ, as a guest, and he talked very eloquently about how open source is not a democracy, despite how people think it is, especially, I think, from people from the older Embraco times where you had far more control, obviously, over what was happening because so much more of the product was built by the community and features were built by the community as a result of the community thinking that these would be a good idea, and the roadmap wasn't as mature and the gates weren't kept as tightly closed, or however I should be phrasing it. And so, yes, and you can see it from both ways, of course, how frustrating it must be if you cannot see your reasoning for why you shouldn't add that simple little toggle. I remember talking at Code Garden where it was archetype, nested content and the grid, and I was representing team nested content on stage, and I seem to remember a question came up about it, but the great thing was that Lee and Matt were sitting, and you were both sitting in the front row, and so I was able to just get a microphone to you so you could answer it on my behalf. But it's just a small thing, but people did get quite emotional about it. But I think you make a fair point, Matt, is it was at a time when we felt people perhaps felt they were losing their input, losing their say. And so it was a very public example of sort of why? But it turns out, you know what, we've all survived, haven't we? Mm-hmm. Turns out.
I've just popped into my head. There was a discussion about Models Builder recently on the core repository, where property aliases for Models Builder. You know, it was there was a suggestion of that these should be string constants, right? Which I agree with. These should be. You know, we don't want to stringly type things. It's better to have them as properties or constants on the object. But you know, there was a discussion on which way it should go. And then the answer was to extract out what the Models Builder part is into its own interface, and then just say, oh, roll your own. You know, so it's again another extension point. But because that was becoming an opinion of how to go about doing things that may not fit the wider global view of what Models Builder currently does. Yeah, the answer is to go roll your own rather than introduce this opinion.
I can sort of see where they're coming from, to be honest. Not necessarily agree with it, because it's sort of a reaction to where the framework version of Embraco was, and it had a lot of stuff baked in, like packages for an example of how things should be done. And there was definitely a decision to go, let's just go pure as we can .NET down the line and not do any custom stuff. Now, obviously, there's a line there, and you can say which side you think they are of these things, but I think that's the current thing with anything that goes near the core elements of Embraco, is it's straight down the line as much .NET core way as possible. So it's hard to be opinionated inside the actual core system at the moment. whether it should or shouldn't be is a different thing, but that's, I think, why it's ended up where it is. Because I know there's a reluctance to use any third-party libraries in the app at all, in the framework at all, to the extent that there's some things where there are packages and they're like, is this a package that will get used? And you can see these discussions going on with the new versions. Oh, no, we're not going to do that because it's not a Microsoft package. So keep it that completely pure, not even making that opinion. I'm not 100% sold on that, but that's not my decision to make, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if this is because they've been burnt in the past. You know, when I think of, like, dependencies on say, like, AutoMapper, and then they make, you know, Umbraco Mapper, and then the Nutanesoft JSON library, it's now coming over to use the other one too.
Well, I mean, exactly, and from I've seen that from the other side, because I'm now thinking of wrapping, I'm wrapping a lot of stuff before I get to that things, because, I mean, I've got that Nutanesoft everywhere, and I'm thinking I'm going to obviously have to replace it, but I'm probably going to replace it with a wrapper that is then got Nutanesoft in it, or that, so I can transition from A to B. But I think that is why, in the core of Umbraco at the moment, everything's a Microsoft package or a .NET Core package, and there isn't that, because potentially putting the opinions into something that big. I mean, we all know, because our packages are the same. You put an opinion into it, it has a ripple effect on other people. No.
But it's a fine line, because then you start to go down the road of, if it's not invented here, so if it's not something that you've written, then you're not going to include it. But then all that means is you end up either reinventing the wheel and re-implementing something that already exists, but then you're also not the specialist in that. So that, I guess the reason to use NuGet packages is because somebody spent a lot of time, there's a lot more people with that particular focus on developing that solution. Mm. And by not using that, you're meaning you're going to have to implement that, and you don't have as big a domain knowledge potentially in that area than everybody that's contributed to that. So it's a difficulty, and that probably extends to the front end now as well. I know they decided on Lit wrapping around web components, and I think web components is a good idea, and I think Lit's quite a nice solution as well. But it's from what I've seen in the current new UI code, and I need to, admittedly, this hasn't been a while since I've looked in good detail again, but it's just, are there things that you could be using libraries for that you're re-implementing for the sake of not having a dependency?
Yeah.
But I understand why. Like, we've seen it many times before in terms of you've got a dependency on something and it's all the fashion and all the rage now. But then it doesn't take long, especially in the JavaScript world, for something that was the de facto way of doing it. And then next week, it's like everybody's, I can't believe you're still using that.
Mm. It's true in .NET Core as well.
Well, I was going to say even in the testing world. So not that long ago, everything was Cypress. Like, Cypress was the new way to be doing testing. Now it's Playwright. So it's forever changing, and you can understand why you wouldn't want that dependency, but it's just what I'm saying in terms of that fine line. When do you choose to have a dependency and risk that happening? Or I guess, like what you've been saying, Kevin, in terms of putting wrappers around it, how much time do you invest in making the integration in such a way that it can be swapped out, even though it potentially won't be? So it's again, do we spend time building these wrappers for something that we really doubt we're ever going to change, but we don't know.
I'm very much, when it happened, I'm like, oh no, that would be much better now if it was one and a retrofitter, because I am not architecting a lot of all my code. I am writing it and then going back and going, oh, that should have been something different. So I'm much more catching myself out than I am planning, I'll be perfectly honest.
Can I ask a question back? Are there any opinions that you've done real 180s? On in things that you were really convinced one way, but now you realize the error of your ways? I mean, let's be fair though, context means everything, doesn't it? So that's usually why.
I mean, I've done the thing. So
I really want the answer to be we shouldn't have let nested content go into core, but you couldn't have stopped that though, could you? Because it's open source, right? So you either did it in a happy way or they probably just did it anyway.
Well, so someone had to someone would have to have done it, and the person who would have done it would have had to sort of ethically say, is this the right thing to do? So, yeah, I don't think it would have gone. If we didn't do it, I don't think it would have gone into the core. As it is, you know, like the difference with, like, you know, block lists, you know, when the block list got built, that was like considered an evolution. You know, they wrote, you know, Umbreco have written that from scratch. I mean, they may have based a lot of it on nested content, but they own that. You know, that's what they've done. So
I don't think there's stuff that I'm like fundamentally 180'd on, but there's definitely always a progression. So I think the thing with why I probably never written a starter for how to compile your packages and build them in that way is every single one of mine ends up being somewhat different. Like, you've learned something new, so your opinion just evolves, or like I say, some new tool comes out, and like, I was on Nuke build for a while and now I've ended up been in that, and it's not necessarily a 180, it's just that I've learned that I was actually deficient in another area, and by fixing that knowledge, it made it redundant rather than, I still think it's a very good tool, I just don't think I've got a good use case for it now. So there's evolution, and there's constant change in that regard as well.
You see, with USync, it's probably changed about 4 times in reality over its time. When I started it, I was using the package service, which was wrong because it didn't necessarily sync, but it was a quick hack start to get the stuff out and in, but the package service doesn't truly sync. So you start with this thing that generates XML and you think it's great, and then you realize all the fundamental flaws and you spend an entire version pulling it back out of the code. That's how USync started, and that's why it's XML now. Might not be XML if you started tomorrow, but it's not such a difference that I would rip out the XML-based file format and change it now. Changing the file format from version 7 to version 8, I did for sound architectural reasons to make the code nice and neat. But now, and for every 6 months, I go, if I hadn't done that, then all this migration stuff would be way easier. But I did it. I think the code's way easier. So it's a hard one to say. My opinion, if I did it again, I'm not sure. I chose at the time, I was like, Umbreco 8 has a migration path inside Umbreco. The core team have written a way of getting from 7 to 8. So I'm not going to do that in USync. USync's not going to be the migration tool. And that was my party line for a long time, until certain people named Lee harassed me when I think I, to be fair, had half written because of how I keep having these thoughts of like, but it would be really easy to use it. But yeah, so I've gone round and round on that. And the reality is, every time that I haven't done this since about version 7, a major rewrite of USync was like, well, the way I've done it wrong, it needs to be neater. And even now, I think Matt's probably had an insight when we did the vendor stuff. It could be easier to integrate with USync. The architecture's a bit weird. But it's not so bad that I would completely 180 on the way it's written. But it's not perfect. But then it's also 13 years old in bits. So, you know, nothing ever is.
So thank you, Lottie, for joining us today. It was very informative.
Velkommen, I think, and if that's the right Danish.
Yeah.
I'm practicing for Code Garden, you see, because obviously when we go to Denmark, because all of us are going to Code Garden, aren't we? Yeah, just looking at the screen. Lee's nodding. Good. Yes. Of course, we're going to all have to speak Danish all the time. Not.
I've got to learn Danish book. I haven't opened it yet.
I've been doing a bit of Duolingo recently because I've realized it's sort of, what, 10 years that I've been going to Denmark, and still only being able to say hello and goodbye is pretty pathetic. But anyway, I look forward to seeing you all at Code Garden is what I really meant to say.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Been a pleasure.
Thank you. See you all next week.
Yeah. That's all we've got time for this week. Why don't you smash like, subscribe, and whatever the other buttons are, and listen to us on your favorite podcast thing. And ta-ra-la.